Done.
Fourth, we need to reform our criminal justice system. This is not a political issue. It is a leadership issue, and it has dramatic manifestations throughout our society. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Since I doubt we are the most evil people in the world, many now agree that maybe we're doing something wrong. Millions of our citizens are either in prison or under the supervision of the criminal justice system. During my time in the Senate, we worked exhaustively to examine every component of this process, from point of apprehension to length of sentencing to the elements of life in prison, including prison administration, and to the challenge of reentering society and hopefully living productive lives. When one applies for a job, the stigma of having been in prison is like a tattoo on your forehead. In many cases, prison life creates scars and impediments that can only be remediated through structured reentry programs. Millions of Americans are now in this situation, many of them nonviolent offenders who went to prison due to drug use and drug dependence. To those who wonder whether we can or should put such programs in place, my answer is this. Do you want to see these former offenders back on the street, coming after your money or your life? Or do you want them in a job, making money and having a life? Finally, let's find a way to return to good governance. It'll take time, but it's possible to rebalance the relationship between the executive and legislative branches and to carefully manage the federal government, which is surely the most complex bureaucracy in the world. A lot of people running for president and a lot of people covering those who are running for president seem to skip past the realities of governing into the circus of the political debate. The federal bureaucracy is huge and Byzantine. I've seen many people come to public service from highly successful careers in the business world only to be devoured and humiliated by the demands of moving policy through the bureaucracy and then the Congress. The very administration of our government needs to be fixed. And with the right leadership and a right sense of priorities, it can be. I spent 4 years as a Marine, 4 more as a full committee counsel in the Congress, 5 years in the Pentagon, 1 as a Marine, and 4 as a defense executive sitting on the Defense Resources Board, 6 years as a member of the United States Senate. I am well aware and appreciate that there are a lot of highly talented, dedicated people in our federal workforce, and I know they would be among the first to agree that we would benefit by taking a deep breath and basically auditing the entire federal government in order to re-justify the functioning of every program and every office. The way to solve these challenges and others is the way that other such challenges have always been solved in the past. Find good leaders. Tell them where the country needs to go. Free them up to use their own creative energies. Trust their integrity. Supervise. Hold them accountable, just as they should hold our own people accountable, their own people accountable, and just as the American people should hold every national leader accountable. Have the courage of your convictions. Have the humility to listen to others. Remember the greatness of our country and the sacrifices that have gone before us, and never forget that history should and will judge all of us if we ever let the American dream die. Thank you.
Thank you. We will now go into our Q&A session, and as I said to the senator beforehand, we'll try to make it rapid fire as to get as much as we can in this next few minutes. Sir, are you considering pursuing the Democratic nomination for president? Would you consider running as an independent?
I would say we've had a lot of discussions among people that I respect and trust about the future of the country, and we are going to continue having these discussions over the next 4 or 5 months, and I'm seriously looking at the possibility of running for president. But we want to, you know, see if there's a support base from people who would support the programs that we're interested in pursuing with the leadership. So the answer is, I'm a Democrat. I have strong reasons for being a Democrat. Basically, if you want true fairness in the society, you want to give a voice in the corridors of power to the people who otherwise would not have it, I believe that will come from the Democratic Party, and we're taking a hard look, and we'll get back to you in a few months.
What trait is most important in a person wanting to become our president, and what is your best trait?
How many questions do you have on that stack before you pull that one out? You know, I think trust and integrity and vision, and loyalty. You cannot run or lead unless you have that, and unless you have that in the people who are with you too. And it's one thing I used to tell my staff when I was in the Senate, was that I met every day with Cap Weinberger when he was Secretary of Defense. I met with him every day for 4 years, and you will never see one word that was ever said in that meeting when the door is closed. I owe that to him and to good governance. But I think the issues of character override even issues of intelligence. I hate to put it that way, but I'd rather have someone who is really loyal and who can be trusted than someone who is smart and couldn't be trusted.
Hillary Clinton, of course, is widely seen as the Democratic front runner for president in 2016. What do you see as her strengths and weaknesses?
Well, I've had the pleasure of working with Hillary Clinton when we were in the Senate and at times when she was Secretary of State, and I must say she has a much broader forum than I do to answer that question.
A follow-up regarding Mrs. Clinton. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State for 4 years. How responsible is she for the tangled mess of U.S. foreign policy that you cited in your remarks?
Again, I think that's a question that really should be directed at Secretary Clinton. I'm not here to undermine her. I'm here just to explain where my concerns are as someone who's been involved in the military and in foreign policy all of my life. It wasn't even a political comment when I made it. It's a more comment about leadership and how we need to be much clearer in terms of our national goals and our objectives around the world.
As someone who didn't really embrace the task of being a politician while serving in the Senate, why are you considering a run for president when that job demands so much politicking to be effective?
You know, I think a lot of people misunderstand the approach that we took during my time in the Senate and how much I valued being a part of the United States Senate. I look at these positions more as opportunities to lead rather than to conduct politics per se. I was raised on the notion of what it takes to be a leader. And I think if you look at what we were able to do during our six-year period in the Senate, it's pretty remarkable. And we did it by bringing strong, dedicated people into the staff, trusting them, giving them what the Marine Corps would be called mission-oriented orders, and approaching issues such as criminal justice that a lot of other people in the country were afraid to touch, and bringing them to a place where we bring these issues out of the shadows and into the public debate. So it's a very tough thing to run for office, but it's also the way that the American people get to know you and to make their own decisions about whether they want to trust you, and that's the process of a democracy.
A related question. What's appealing about the job of president when partisanship and unwillingness in Congress to compromise and work together makes getting even little things done so hard.
I think with the right leadership, we can get a lot of things done in this country. And we've seen this over and over again. I'm going to give you a bipartisan historical response to that. This country was completely in the doldrums when Franklin Roosevelt took over. People had a feeling of hopelessness that things couldn't be done. He came in with vision and leadership, put programs into place all over the country. Things started to change. By the way, many of us lived through the Carter administration, and if you recall, in 1979, 1980, there were a lot of people saying nothing can get done. Everything is so paralyzed. People were even writing that the presidency was now too big for any one person to handle. And Ronald Reagan came in. He was a leader. Some of my Democratic friends don't like it when I say that. Ronald Reagan was once a Democrat. He was still a leader. But he brought strong people around him. He had a vision where he wanted to take the country, and things started moving again. Leadership in this world requires that you sit down and talk to people and give them a clear vision of where you want to go and listen to them. And I think we did this probably most clearly when we got the GI Bill through the United States Congress. I wrote this bill with legislative counsel before I was sworn in to the Senate. We introduced it on my first day. We worked extremely hard across the aisle. We got two Republican key sponsors, two Democrat sponsors, two World War II veterans, two Vietnam veterans, and in 16 months, we got a bill through a paralyzed Congress that now more than a million of the veterans, post-9/11 veterans, have been able to use and really change their lives.
You have opposed U.S. military intervention in Iraq and Libya previously. Please tell us your reaction to President Obama beginning airstrikes in Syria last night, and perhaps you would also like to respond to the remarks that the president made 3 hours ago.
I would start, and Mark Shields will remember this, I'll start with a comment that was given to me when I was in Beirut reporting for the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour more than 30 years ago. I was out on a Marine outpost, Marine platoon, that started taking fire from a Druze outpost because there was a Lebanese army position co-located with the Marines. And then some unknown militia started joining in just because it was Beirut. And then the Syrians came up over one ridgeline and were firing 25-millimeter down into it. And a young Marine turned around to me and he said, "Sir, never get involved in a five-sided argument." And during the hearings, when I was still in the Senate and they were considering doing something in Syria, that was one of the points that I would raise, that if you think Lebanon was bad, you know, Syria is Lebanon on steroids. Just look at the situation that we now are in. ISIS, whatever, however you want to define that, and we need to be very careful to define what the membership of these entities really is, because in that part of the world, people tend to drift in and out of different organizations depending on who they think is getting something done. We have ISIS, who supposedly is anti-Assad and wants to create this caliphate up there, and then now we're going to arm and train another Syrian opposition whose mission up until a couple of weeks ago was to help take out Assad. Now they're supposedly going to fight ISIS. We have a quiet agreement with the Syrian government at this time, one would assume from what I'm hearing. The same government that the president a couple of years ago said must go. We have the a tacit participation by Iran on some level, the country that many in the region believe we should be most concerned about. And it just shows you that is this region. It has been this region for 2,000 years. And what I have been saying since I was Secretary of the Navy, not just before the Iraq War, is that the United States can assert its national security interests in that part of the world, but we should never become an occupying force in that part of the world. So when I look at what the president, the strikes that the president ordered, I would say this. If he is ordering these strikes based on the notions of international terrorism, to borrow from the remarks that I made, if he's saying this is an international terrorist entity and the national security interests of the United States are directly threatened and he is conducting limited strikes, I would say that is legal. That is legal. The question of judgment would remain to be seen. And I think I'm going to stop right there. Folks, this is a very, very complicated part of the world, and we have to deal with our national security in a way that is and make sure that we do not get entangled on the ground again.
President Obama's advisors are saying that attacking al-Qaeda affiliate Khorasan last night is not an expansion of the U.S. military mission because Congress authorized war against al-Qaeda over a decade ago. Do you agree with that reasoning?
I had not heard them say that, but I would expect them to say that. And it goes to what the portion of my remarks where I said that even without the congressional authorization they are mentioning, we have the right of self-defense under international law and under the United Nations Charter if there is an international terrorist organization that directly threatens our national security interests. So in that context, these types of limited raids are really no different than what we have been doing in places like Yemen.
Do you think that the Obama administration is handling, how do you think the Obama administration is handling the situation in Ukraine? And how would you deal with Vladimir Putin if you were president?
I do believe that this administration has been taking the right approach with respect to the situation in Ukraine. First, this is the issue of the Russian involvement in Ukraine involves larger players in historic Europe, countries like Germany, which have an impact on the actions of the Russians. Second, it's possible, always possible, for the Russians to have overplayed their hand. And we saw this actually with the Soviets in Afghanistan in 1979, where they went in, they overplayed their hand, and over time they had to adjust their policies. So I believe the policy of sanction and working with our European partners is the best way to go. What we can be thankful for right now, by the way, is that Ukraine did not become a member of NATO, as many people were advocating during the time that I was in the Senate, because if they were members of NATO, we would be obligated to come to their defense militarily in some of these situations. We need to preserve our options and to work with our European partners.
Going domestically for a few questions. Does it bother you that all the big financial firms and banks found responsible for the 2008 Great Recession have only had to pay fines? Are we monetizing felonies?
Let me just say this. I've got to give you a little historical marker here. When we had to vote on whether to provide $700 billion under what was called the TARP program, to appropriate $700 billion to a lot of companies who had, I think, abused our economic system, I called a lot of people trying to get their thoughts on which way I should vote. And one of the pieces of advice that I appreciated most came from an individual named Martin Biggs, who was with Morgan Stanley for many years. He helped me when I was bringing American companies into Vietnam many years ago. A very, very smart macroeconomic thinker and someone who had made a lot of money in the financial sector. And I said, which way do you think I should vote on this? It's a three-page handwritten memorandum that says give these people $700 billion because of the mistakes they made. He said, number one, you have to do this. He said, if we do not stanch the bleeding within weeks, the economic systems in the world economy will have a cataclysmic freefall. Number two, he said, we need to re-regulate. We need to get back to proper regulation of the financial sector. He said that as a hedge fund guy. And he said, number three, you really ought to find a way to punish. And that was his word. You ought to really find a way to punish the people who created this situation, whose negligence and activities created this situation. So with that in mind, we worked from our office to pass a windfall profits tax. I'm not big on long-term taxes like that, but after reading an article by Martin Wolf in the Financial Times, actually, a very conservative economic newspaper, where he was recommending, because these companies got bailed out through the monies of the average working people in this country, the tax monies of the average working people in this country, they ought to pay. They ought to pay back in. And so we put together a refined piece of legislation that basically said if you were one of, I think there were 13 companies that got more than a certain amount, the very top amount from the TARP program, and you're an executive, you get your full compensation and $400,000 a bonus on regular taxation, but anything above your $400,000 bonus, you split half and half. You split 50-50 with the people who bailed you out. I thought that was extremely reasonable, and the most interesting thing about it was when we got it to the Senate floor, it really was the Democrats who didn't want to vote on it, not the Republicans. Nobody wanted to touch it, and as a result, we didn't get a vote on it.
One more question before we go to some questions about veterans. Do you believe that Obamacare is a step forward toward creating economic fairness? Why or why not?
The whole issue of Obamacare, I think, was the most difficult issue that we faced during my time in the Senate, whether to eventually vote in favor of it or not. And first I would say I believe the administration made an error, a strategic error, of calling for that legislation at the time that they did, which was the beginning of their administration. It was an issue that had been very popular during the election cycle, but you will remember 2 months before the election, the economy crashed. And to bring something this vast and potentially costly as your flagship piece of legislation at a time when the economy was still suffering was not a strategically smart thing to do, quite frankly. There were a lot of pieces in this legislation I did not like. I voted with the Republicans 18 times on different amendments, trying to bring the legislation to a place that I was more comfortable with. In the end, I did vote for it. And I'll tell you what was in my mind when I did. Let's say this is 50.1% what you like and 49.9% what you don't. But my mother grew up in East Arkansas in some pretty difficult surroundings. She was one of eight children. And three of her siblings died in childhood, not childbirth, childhood, as did her father when she was 10. And there wasn't medical care in East Arkansas at the time. And if you go back to that period in the 1930s, even on issues like do we create Social Security, any program that was put up where the government was going to take a greater responsibility for the individuals, to go back and look at it, they're all screaming, you know, this is socialism. How are you going to have Social Security for these people? In the 1960s, Medicare comes along. It's socialism, you know. So that really pushed me over. I think there's to vote in favor of it, and I don't regret voting in favor of it. But there's a lot in this program that could be tightened and adjusted, and I would hope that's where the Congress can come together after this election. It's not going to go away. Let's tighten it up and make it better.
We have many veterans in the audience, including yourself. I'd like to ask a general one and have you respond before we conclude. Many veterans are struggling to find work. Is there more we can do to ensure that the men and women who serve are better prepared to enter the civilian workforce?
What I would like to see is a better understanding among potential employers about the value that a veteran can bring to the workplace. We've had discussions over the years on this issue. I was a counsel on the House Veterans Committee when I finished law school after leaving the Marine Corps, worked on this for many, many years. And if you're in the military today and you're an officer and have been able to not only have a college degree, but have the, in many cases, an advanced degree, and you've got a skill set that people in the civilian world can understand, you don't have a terribly difficult time selling yourself. If you are enlisted, particularly non-career enlisted, the citizen soldiers, the people that I designed this GI Bill for, you interrupt your life. You go out and pull a pump or two in Iraq, Afghanistan. You come back, and some of the best leaders in that environment are the ones who are in the combat arms. But they come to an employer, and they've got a DD-214. It doesn't have, you know, a degree or a computer school. It says I was a squad leader. We need to have a better understanding among potential employers what that means. That means I had to get things done every day. I had to lead people. I had to motivate them. I had to work across ethnic and other lines. I learned how to lead and how to get things done. And the more people understand that, then the easier it becomes to resolve the issues that you mentioned.
We are almost out of time, but before asking the last question, we have a couple of housekeeping matters to take care of. First of all, I'd like to remind you about our upcoming events and speakers on October 15th. Deborah Rutter, the new president of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, will outline her plans for the center's future. October 20th, Thomas Perez, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Labor. And October 21st, Bob Bowlsby, Commissioner of the Big 12 Conference. Next, I'd like to present our guests with the traditional National Press Club mug. I trust you have a set at home, and this you can add to it. Okay? And our final question. Sir, two of our greatest presidents, Teddy Roosevelt and FDR, had backgrounds at the Department of the Navy. Do you sense a trend developing there?
Unfortunately, we're not cousins. So. Thank you very much. Thank all of you for being here.
Thank you all. We are adjourned.
Next, a Congressional Black Caucus town hall on voting and the midterm elections. We also plan to have live coverage of the president's remarks at tonight's CBC Foundation dinner. And after that, some of the speakers from the Family Research Council's Values Voters Summit. The Congressional Black Caucus Foundation held its annual legislative conference in Washington, D.C. this week. Next, former president for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, Elaine Jones, and Democratic Representatives Javier Becerra and John Lewis look at the midterm elections, new voter ID laws, and their impact on the African-American vote. This is just under 2 hours.
Good morning. It is an honor to be here with this distinguished panel, with the leadership of the foundation. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here with each and every one of you. We're about to hear a wonderful, wonderful presentation, an exchange of ideas about something so very fundamental, the right to vote. So I will be brief. Dr. King said, one of the most significant steps we can take is the short walk to the voting booth. And that is what we all have to do in the election. A few weeks ago, we had the privilege of bestowing the Congressional Gold Medal on Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. It was so remarkable because it was so overdue, but also because at the very same time, we were appealing to our colleagues to pass the Bipartisan Voting Rights Act to correct the Shelby decision. That still hasn't happened. We must make it happen, but in order to make that happen, we all must vote. As I said, it's a privilege to be here to accept the invitation of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. Another privilege I had more than a year ago was standing on the steps with the Congressional Black Caucus, our very distinguished chair, Congresswoman Marcia Fudge, and members of CBC, on the steps of the Supreme Court. We were there calling upon the court to make the right decision. That very day, we were meeting in the House of Representatives to dedicate the statue of Rosa Parks. It just seems so strange. We're dedicating a statue to Rosa Parks. People turn out in a bipartisan way to salute her, and yet we have to appeal to the court to do the right thing. And when they don't, they come and sing the praises of Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott King, but don't pass the Voting Rights Act. So we have important work to do, and we have important people doing it. The distinguished chair of the foundation, Chaka Fatah, has been working for children, for cities, for the American people. He's a great leader. Marcia Fudge, a very strong leader and fighter for opportunity for all in our country and taking the lead on fighting for food stamps and the rest in a very, very tough battle, but who better than she to lead on that score and so many others. Our assistant leader, Mr. Clyburn, a champion on the Voting Rights Act. He, along with John Conyers, working so hard for us to get that passed. Our chairman, Mr. Conyers being one of them, Mr. Cummings, working very hard to make sure to set the record straight as some in Congress would constantly be on the attack of President Barack Obama. Benny Thompson, our chair of Homeland, our ranking member, hopefully soon to be chair of the Homeland Security Committee to keep America safe. Maxine Waters, distinguished chair of financial services, looking out for consumers and our financial system so that it's fair to everyone. Eddie Bernice Johnson, all of the talk that we've heard about science, technology, and math. She's the chair of the Science and Technology Committee. The Congressional Black Caucus has provided such tremendous leadership to our country. We will have a new member, Bobby Scott will be the chairman of the education. I say chairman optimistically, but he will be the top Democrat on the Education and Labor Committee, following up on his important work for young people and workers in our country. So this caucus is making a valuable contribution to our country. Even some who are not chairs of the caucus or committees, Emanuel Cleaver and Congresswoman Clay were there in Ferguson and made us all so proud as they represented us in a way that was appropriate and respectful of the very serious nature of what happened there. And they, along with John Lewis, whom you'll be hearing from, the conscience of the Congress, they call the Black Caucus, he's certainly very much a part of that. But so much needs to be done. Ferguson, say the word, conjures up so much that needs to be done. Voting Rights Act. Freeing people to vote, have the right to vote with respect for who they are. So I thank Shanice Washington and Jeff Johnson for their leadership, Valerie Long, so many people who are making today possible. As I said, it's an honor for me to be here to salute the members of the Congressional Black Caucus led by Marsha Fudge in the Congress, Chaka Fatah, with the foundation. And how about those fellows that we met? And how about the fact that some of the fellowships were named for Donald Payne? For Donald Payne, that beautiful, lovely man. And for Congressman Stokes, Chairman Stokes, a distinguished leader. And so the tradition goes on about education, which is key to the fulfillment of these young people, which is also necessary for to keep America number one. And I just leave you with one thought. One way we hope to turn out a big vote in all communities and the vote in this Congressional Black Caucus leadership community is so important is what Jeff said. It's about jobs, keeping good paying, jumpstart the middle class, good paying jobs here in America, investing in education to keep America number one. And that means we have to invest heavily in historical black colleges as well as reduce the cost of loans to kids. And the very important part of it to the community is when women succeed, America succeeds. That's how we think we're going to turn out a big vote. Thank you for the honor of having a chance to say a few words. Good luck in your deliberations. We're all counting on you, and I know the success of this conference will be the success of our country. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Congresswoman. And she said it right. The panel that we are getting ready to go into is going to cover ambitiously three key areas. One is the state of the African-American vote moving into 2014, the necessity to look at both voting and law enforcement reform as it relates to policy, and then also where we are going and how the black vote affects us socioeconomically. That's a lot to cover in a short amount of time, but we have a brilliant panel that's going to do that. And I'm going to be introducing folks that are in the audience every now and again. You know how we are. We got to do shout outs. Congresswoman Beatty said that I'm no stranger to the Congressional Black Caucus. And if I could just take a point of personal privilege, I think it's important because it's not just been for me about supporting the jobs tour that the Congressional Black Caucus did or getting on the road to be able to support different members in certain parts of the country. It's that before anybody knew me, when I was a senior in high school in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, there was a woman who was county prosecutor by the name of Stephanie Tubbs Jones. And she came into my high school government class and blew me away. And I said to myself, I need to work for her. And I asked my teacher if I could walk her to her car as she was leaving the classroom. And I said to, at that time, Prosecutor Tubbs Jones, I said, you're going to hire me. And anybody that knows her knows that look. Like, what are you talking about? I don't know you. She said, are you a lawyer? I said, no. She said, I only hire lawyers. come back to me after you go to law school? I said, well, lawyers have files, right? She said, yes. I said, you got a file room where those files are. She said, yes. I said, you need somebody to get files for lawyers in that file room. She said, you're funny. Come see me on Monday. And she hired me in the file room of the county prosecutor's office in Cleveland, Ohio. And that set up a trajectory for me to be where I am. And so I just felt it was necessary. We talked about honoring those that have come before. And Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones was one of the most powerful black women that we've seen in the halls of Congress. And on days like today, I just remember her so much and want to lift her up. And so it's my honor and privilege to introduce those that will lead us in our discussion today. Please hold your applause till the end. Wade Henderson is president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund. As a tireless civil rights leader and advocate, he is a member of the bar in the District of Columbia and the United States Supreme Court. Elaine Jones was first female president and director of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She is a legal powerhouse and a civil rights lawyer who was elected to the American Bar Association Board of Governors in 1989, the first African-American to do so. In December of 2000, President Clinton presented her with the Eleanor Roosevelt Human Rights Award. Representative John Lewis was elected to Congress in 1986 and represents the 5th Congressional District of Georgia. This civil rights leader was a freedom rider, spoke at the 1963 March on Washington in 2011, and he also received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Barbara Onwine is president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. A graduate of Duke University Law School, she continues to champion civil rights and racial justice issues nationally and internationally. She specializes in the areas of housing and lending, community development, employment, voting rights, education, and environmental justice. Representative Javier Becerra is the chairman of the House Democratic Caucus. He's a former deputy attorney general with the California Department of Justice and was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1992. He's a member of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, where he served as chair during the 105th Congress. Representative Becerra is also a member of the Executive Committee of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus. And last but certainly not least is a leader who I met while I was working in that file room in Cleveland, Ohio. She was chief of staff at that time, but she is an unbelievable public servant from my home state, representing the 11th Congressional District in such an unbelievable way. She chairs the Congressional Black Caucus and is continuing on every single level to be an unbelievable freedom fighter, even as she is a powerful legislator. Ladies and gentlemen, Representative Marsha Fudge.
All right.
You all please have a seat. Now, I have to ask an unbelievable favor. As we are addressing these three major themes of the state of the black vote, of the necessity to look at reform of voting and law enforcement policy, and how the vote is affecting African Americans socioeconomically, I need you all to be mindful that this panel ends today. And so if you could think, as master tweeters do, to be short and prolific in your responses, we will have a great panel. I would like to start with Representative Lewis, if I can. Congressman Lewis, there is clearly an impact that recent legislation in particular and civil rights and Supreme Court cases have had on voting rights and voting rights for African Americans. What have the last 2 years in particular done to the African American electorate? And more importantly, if there is one thing that all of us need to be doing moving into November, what is that one thing?
Well, more than anything else, the decision of the United States Supreme Court and local, state officials all across America, not just in the southern states, have made a deliberate effort to take us back to another period. And we must stand up and fight and push by going to the polls and vote like we never voted before. I've said in the past that the vote is precious. It's almost sacred. It controls everything that we do. Everything. And as a minority, whether we be black, Latino, Asian American, Native American, or whether we are white, we must understand that 50 years ago, this year, three young men that I knew, Andy Goodman, Mickey Sherman, and James Chaney, gave their lives trying to make it possible for all of our citizens to become participants in the democratic process. So we got to go out and vote. If we want to respond to Ferguson, we got to vote. It is powerful. We got to do it, and we must do it. If not, we're going to go backwards.
Even as we begin that fight, and many in this room and around the country have consistently been engaged in ensuring that we're registered, ensuring that folks are educated, and making sure that there's robust GOTV. But Congresswoman Fudge, there is, I think, a debate that's happening, even in our community, as we're looking at what happened with the Supreme Court decision. Do we continue to fight for federal voter laws? Or do we more focus on state laws that we're losing in many cases all over the country? Is it a both-and proposition? Or as we move forward into a new space and time, is it an either-or proposition due to lack of resources, limited resources, and the fact that we continue to get beat up on the state level even when we have some federal protection?
Let me say two things. First off, let me thank you, as well as to say to this audience that he's a little modest. When he came to work in the prosecutor's office, he was a world-class track athlete. So he was not only bright, he was doing all of the right things, the things that we want our young people to do. So I thank you for still being who you are. As it relates to, it's not an either or. You know, when we were kids, we used to say, I can walk and chew bubblegum at the same time. And we can. We can work on both tracks. I think that if we don't, we make a huge mistake. The reason we are in the shape we're in partially is because of redistricting. And we did that because we lost the state houses. If we had not lost the state houses, we may be in a much better position than we are today. But I think that the thing that people need to understand is what is at stake in this election. I mean, we know that we need to vote, and we all know why we need to vote. But let me just say these few things, if I may. If we don't vote, believe it or not, they are going to file articles of impeachment against our president. If we don't vote, the street in front of your house is not going to get fixed. If we don't vote, we're going to have hungry children across this country because they're going to keep cutting SNAP and WIC. We have to understand that this election is about us. It is not about the people who are running. It is about the policies that we need to be supporting. If you don't vote, I just say you're selfish and sorry. So let's go tell the people to go out here and vote.
Congressman Becerra, to Congresswoman Fudge's point, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. But if we are, even those of us that are inside the political bubble, are looking around, I hear conversation every day about the need to secure the seats in the House and potentially move some seats forward. I hear about securing the Senate and ensuring that Democrats stay on the front end there for those that are playing party politics. But I don't hear the same level of fervor and enthusiasm about down-ballot candidates that are drastically going to affect quality of life in states all over the country. Mm-hmm. As we talk about walking and chewing gum at the same time, how can we ensure that we're doing the kind of work that leads people to the polls, that push forward the kind of representatives we want in the House and Senate, but not at the cost of poorly educating folks on those down ballot seats, many of whom still have an opportunity to win in certain states?
Jeff, let me begin by first saying thank you for being here and for allowing me to be with all these great leaders that are here. To the point, I think Marcia hit it right on the money there, and I think Congressman Lewis gave us the proper perspective. What we find is that after 2008 and 2012, when the black vote set historic numbers, that Republicans went on the offense, and they said, we got to stop this. And so they've been playing offense for the last 4 years. And they've been going after that vote, not by trying to persuade you not to vote, by not making it possible for you to vote.
Right.
And so what we got to stop is playing defense. We're fighting the Supreme Court decisions. We're fighting to change laws at state and federal levels. And so what we should do is take the offense. I don't think you're going to take the offense only if you concentrate at the federal or at the local level. As Marcia said, you got to do both. And Jeff, I think the response here is we got to teach our young folk that voting is a right, but it's not just a right. It's a rite of passage. If you don't vote, it's like you want to learn how to drive? It's a rite of passage. You got to show me that you deserve to drive that car. You want to be a man? You want to be a leader, a woman or man who's leading this country? You got to show me that you know the importance of voting. And so it's got to be a conviction that it is a rite of passage for our young folks to vote. That means we got to teach them. And I don't think it makes any difference if it's a city council seat or if it's a congressional seat or if it's for the president of the United States. Our young folks have to understand the value of voting for that little town hall city council person or for the president of the United States. When we do that, it makes no difference how these anti-voters want to push us. We will be on the offense and we will win.
Thank you, Congressman. But Barbara, I'm concerned because I hear Congressman Becerra and I agree. But as someone who has worked at the NAACP, People for the American Way, a number of the organizations at the national level, and even worked on the pop culture side to engage young voters, I hear the language of voting being important. And I hear it specifically during targeted periods. But if we're talking about offense, in many cases, the enemy that many of us are fighting never takes a day off. When do we move beyond this notion that fighting for the vote starts and ends somewhere around the time campaigning starts?
That's right.
And that whether it's our churches, our civic organizations, and our leadership begin to have messages and movements that don't turn on and off, that we engage funders so that funders aren't only funding during periods of time. How do we create a movement that is larger, more comprehensive, and more 360 than, frankly, we've seen in several decades?
Thank you for that question.
I figured you would like that.
Because, listen, everyone, voting has to be 365 days a year. It cannot only be about showing up for an election, although that's key, because that's how you manifest it. You know, if you don't give a gift on Christmas, well, you know, what happened? So the most important thing for people right now is we know, Jeff, that for every one of us who knows that November 4th is Election Day, that four other people have no idea, not a clue. Not a clue. Our duty is to create the massive microphone to get the word out to every single person we know. My mother's 83 years old. She will be on the phone calling everybody in our family saying, honey, child, are you registered? Because registration is going to start cutting off for some states as early as October the 7th. So it's very important that we get that word out. And she's going to be on the phone on early voting and election day calling all of my family saying, you better get ready. You got to get to those polls. But see, we got to do that. And we don't do that just by talking. I want to make sure that everybody here knows that we come here today to bring you tools that help you do that. The Lawyers Committee, the Leadership Conference, the NAACP, LDF, all of us, all of our organizations work together. National Action Network, the National Coalition for Black Civic Participation. We put out toolkits that every community group can use. We have a new one that just came out on civic engagement this week. And another one for faith-based communities, another one for youth voters. But what I want to make sure of
is that what those toolkits do is that they talk about not only registering GOTV, the vote, you know, what's going on in the local communities, but they also talk about this issue, about making sure that people stay engaged. Because the problem is, the reason why so many people don't want to go to the polls is they get disgusted with putting people in office who don't do what they were put in office to do. And they get angry when they see that they're not at the school board level making sure their children have the best education. They get upset when the mayor isn't holding the police force accountable.
But let me interject there.
Why we got to make sure that people are held accountable and that we're engaged in this process all the time.
No, because I think you make a great point. Thank you very much. And wait, if you can build on that, because my concern is, again, we throw out the word accountability all the time.
Yes.
And so why aren't we holding mayors accountable? Why aren't we holding school members accountable? Why aren't we holding state legislators accountable? But in cities that have 2,000 churches, very few of those members attend a city council meeting. Places where we have activist organizations, a lot of times they don't show up at the state legislature.
That's what we need.
And so my question is, how do we begin to better engage folks to do what I think Barbara is talking about on a consistent basis?
Jeff, it's a great question. I'm honored to be here, honored to be a part of this conversation. Very important. Look, voting really is the language of democracy, guys. If you don't vote, you don't count. That's number one. Number two, voting should be a nonpartisan issue. It's a national issue. But the truth is, partisanship, and particularly a corrosive, toxic kind of partisanship, has subverted the right to vote and democracy as we know it. I want to give just a brief history lesson of why this issue is important, okay?
And then after you do tell me the how.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you the how. Look, when President Obama was elected in 2008, he shattered every record about voter turnout and participation. In North Carolina, you had a huge turnout of African Americans. In Virginia, in Indiana, it was mind-blowing. But on the night he won the 2008 election, Robert Draper, an author who created a book, Don't Ask Us What We Do, the U.S. House of Representatives, documented a dinner that took place in Washington where Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, the current whip of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, and others came together to talk about not just how to regain power, but how to subvert President Obama's legislative agenda. That was on the night of his inaugural ball. In September of 2009, an obscure congressman from South Carolina by the name of Joe Wilson, who was attending a joint session of the House and Senate, yelled out during a presidential address, "You lie! You lie!" It was an attack on the presidency, and it was an attack on President Obama. He was rewarded with a 9-point victory and a war chest of untold proportions generated by what he did. And in March of 2010, Tea Party activists came to town and spit on Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, hurled racial epithets at John Lewis and other members, and argued that this was really a free exercise of their right to express their views. I mention all of this for the following reason. This is a concerted effort to subvert the president's agenda. It began on the night of his first election. The failure on the part of black voters to respond in 2010, as we responded in 2008, cost us everything. We lost control of state houses. We lost control of our ability to set the state agenda, and we're still paying the price.
Okay, so with all of that.
Yeah, what do we do?
Thank you.
Well,
because I would love if we could put up the slides that show some of the black voter turnout and the variances between 2010 and 2012, and those will come up. But my concern is still about the how, because a lot of times, really quickly, we talk about the electorate, what the electorate didn't do. But a lot of times, I didn't see resources, I didn't see infrastructure, I didn't see organizations in large part pushing to ensure that turnout was going to be at the same level.
Resources for advocacy in the black community and organizing the electorate are scarce. They have not been devoted by the national party structure.